Can I? Hi. Yeah, I'm.
Before she does that, just want to make an advertisement for our speaker next week. Same time, same room, Sibella Raver, who is actually, she's vice provost at New York University, but she's a professor of applied psychology specializing in children's development. And so I'm just making a little plug for coming again next week. We'll still have Girl Scouts to teach. And without further ado,
Hello everyone, thank you and welcome to this event organized by the Center of Poverty Studies Research. I'm Ming Cheng Lo, I'm a professor of sociology, I'm also a faculty of BA at the center. It is my great honor and pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Cheryl Mattingly. Dr. Mattingly is a professor of anthropology in the Department of Anthropology and the Division of Occupational Science and Therapy at the University of Southern California. She's also currently a Dale T. Mortensen Fellow at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Aarhus.
Denmark.
Which is in Denmark, I believe. Dr. Mattingly's primary research and theoretical interests include narrative, moral reasoning, phenomenology, the culture of biomedicine, and chronic illness and disability, as well as race and health disparities in the United States. Dr. Mattingly has been a PI and co-PI on several federally funded grants from the NIH, the Maternal and Child Health, and the Department of Education. And she has published extensively on these topics, including 55 peer-reviewed journal articles and book chapters and 6 books. And her most recent book from 2010, which is entitled The Paradox of Hope, Journey Through a Clinical Borderland, has won the Sterling Book Prize from Society for Psychological Anthropology. And one of her earlier books received the Victor Turner Prize from American Anthropology Association for Healing Dramas and Clinical Plots. So her talk today is entitled Rainbow Mom as Moral Tragedy, African-American Parents as Clinical Border Crossers. So please join me and welcome Dr. Cheryl Mattingly.
Thank you. Thank you for introducing me and for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk to, I know this is a very interdisciplinary group from what I understand. It's a pleasure to talk to a group of people who evidently really care about poverty and are willing to meet together in some interdisciplinary way to think about it. I also understand from Megan that you often have very lively discussions here, and I'm really looking forward to that. But I would, if you don't mind, I would like to actually give my talk first, try to make sure I've whacked it down, I hope, sufficiently so that I give time for discussion, but I'd kind of like to go through the whole thing before we get into that. And although the title is got Rainbow Mom as the first person, I'm actually going to begin with the story, and I'm going to introduce another mother who I will call Andrina. Rainbow Mom will appear, but not quite yet. The first time I interviewed Andrina was in the main lobby of a large urban hospital, a cavernous space, strangely dark, even formidable. Later I could see that the gloom had its comforts, a good place for quiet crying or for staring into nothing. High ceilings, clusters of permanently fixed plastic chairs lined up in rows of 3 or 4 or set together in L shapes. Chairs as neutral as could be in tones of beige and practical brown, placed neatly on the wall-to-wall gray carpet. Some leafy potted plants, plastic too, but the realistic kind, helped divide the room into smaller waiting areas. The lobby always felt empty, odd for a hospital full of children. At one end, almost unnoticeable, was the receptionist desk. Though these are often busy hubs of clinical spaces, this one was far away, which gave the impression of a waiting room with nothing to wait for. Of course, I could have some of these details wrong. This interview took place many years ago, the fall of 1997, and the hospital was redecorated 2 years later. I didn't mean to talk to Andrina in such an anonymous place, but where could I go? This was new research in a new city. Sometimes you can find a cozy enough corner, even in a big hospital, but I didn't know my way around. And Andrina's very ill daughter was lying in a room 3 floors up, so she was not about to go far. I'd only met her once, a week earlier, in her daughter's room on the East Wing. I was introduced by the friendly speech therapist who thought Andrina might be willing to participate in the study my colleagues and I were doing. When I saw her that first time, she was sitting on a chair holding her daughter's hand, a little girl of 4 and a half whose shaved head was barely visible above the white sheets of the bed. The small half room was jammed with people standing, sharing chairs, leaning against the radiator or a wall. The child's father, a grandmother, an older sister, an uncle, a cousin. Before we entered, the speech therapist told me that the parents were separated and Andrina was the one to ask. After some quick introductions, I directed my attention to her. To my surprise, her daughter looked so frail and her mother held her hand so tightly, she smiled and agreed immediately. "Sure, sign me up," she said. "I'd be glad to help." I left a few minutes later with the plan for our first interview. So there we sat, Andrina and I, in the twilight of that lobby, diagonally faced in our plastic chairs, my tape recorder perched between us. Andrina was one of those I could see who wasn't in the mood for leisurely opening remarks. So I said, "Can you tell me the story of your daughter's illness up until now? Just begin at the beginning, wherever that might be for you." And then she started to talk. She talked for an hour and a half with very few questions for me, and there were no wasted words. One episode of that first long story offers me a beginning, too. The more I've considered it over the years, the more it has haunted me, or perhaps beckoned me. After nearly a year of struggling to find out what was wrong with her child, who was growing increasingly ill, Andrina finally got a diagnosis. The relief at being taken seriously by clinicians was quickly replaced by the terror of what she found out. Her daughter had cancer, a brain tumor. As if that news weren't terrible enough, she was pulled aside by one physician who announced that the particular type of cancer her daughter had was the worst kind. Here is how Andrina put it. I'll give you a lobby to look at. "This one doctor, a lady doctor, she came to get me to explain what they were going to do. And she came and she took my daughter and myself to this one room. And she really, Lord, she had me going crazy because she told me, she said, 'Oh, I'm so sorry.' I said, 'So sorry, did you hear something else?' And she said, 'Well, you know, that's the worst one that a kid could have. It's the highest risk kind.' And I said, 'Oh my God,' I started saying, 'Oh, I'm dreaming. It was like something on TV or something. Her dream, a nightmare in fact, seeped through the whole of her life, and as she gradually discovered there was nothing to do but learn how to navigate in it, even learn to make it a new kind of home, a home where she struggled to hope." In this paper, I want to look at this narrative shape of hope, hope that is not merely cherished or passively received, but actively cultivated and practiced. The research I'm drawing from today explores how a group of African-American families, many of them poor, traverse clinical spaces when their children have serious chronic or sometimes critical medical conditions. We, the research group, have also considered these navigations from the perspective of clinicians who at times find themselves confused and uncertain about how to provide care or how to connect with families far removed from their own class and cultural background. Hoping is no mere personal affair when it comes to healthcare in a multicultural urban clinic. It is a border activity. One question that I want to consider here is, how is hope cultivated and how was it thwarted in a border zone? So the lobby. It's become quite popular to talk about life on the borders, not only in politics but in the academy. Across a whole range of disciplines, the recognition that social worlds are porous, that boundaries are fluid and contested, that objects and people are bound together or travel in all manner of unexpected ways, continues to inspire our imagination and provoke our attention. Here I'm thinking about the clinical setting as a kind of borderland, using that metaphor. And so some of the things I'm taking are actually from this book that Ming pointed out. Back here. Cultural travelers like Andrina suddenly find themselves faced with trying to understand and navigate the foreign world of pediatric oncological care. She has new languages to learn, languages of disease, of rehabilitation goals, of x-rays, new social spaces to traverse, radiology labs, oncology reception desk, physical therapy mats, new roles, the patient's mother, the home co-therapist, and new technical competencies to master. How to administer chemotherapy shots to her daughter at home. How to do the OT, occupational therapy treatment home program. How to become deferential to novice clinicians, even when she has acquired better mastery of some of their technical skills. Better, for example, at giving shots to her daughter than some of the nurses were. Most complex, she has the task of trying to create effective partnerships with a vast array of healthcare providers. The lobby is a metaphorical image, suggests more than a spatial borderland, however. It intimates an imaginative space marked by temporal uncertainty. One waits in a lobby not only for a person, a place, an activity, some news, but for the future itself. Temporally, lobbies are spaces of the not yet. In this sense, they suggest a frontier characterized by anticipatory imagination. As I discovered in my earliest research in the clinical world, the imaginative plays a very central role in the cultivation of hope that accompanies serious illness, and I'll say more about this shortly. But very briefly, unbelievably briefly, I'm going to just say, tell you, and we can go back if you have questions, about the methods of this research and a little bit about the parameters. So you know I did research and I don't just make up stories. Or even if I just make them up, still there is research behind it. I shouldn't even joke about that. I'm an anthropologist. You need to take me seriously. You might be economists in the room. The story that I told you, the research I'm going to talk about today, is based on an urban ethnography, a longitudinal ethnography that began back in 1997 and went on until officially only ending in 2011. And the interdisciplinary team, I haven't done this by myself, it's been a whole mixed team of people with clinical backgrounds who have been trained as ethnographers, as well as a group of anthropologists, linguistic, medical, psychological. We followed a cohort of a little over 50 African-American children with an array of chronic illnesses or disabilities. So it's not been a medical diagnosis-driven study. We've been interested in the experience and the practice around chronicity. And so we get kids and we get families and we get the practitioners if they want to sign up who serve them. So altogether we've had almost 600 participants. So it's not so small, and hundreds of thousands of pages of data. All right, health disparities. It's a little bit, can you read, see this? It's a little, anyway, this is not really a very interesting slide, but just to say, I'm sure all of you are quite, or many of you, if you're interested in healthcare at all, know something about health disparities research. And I don't really want to talk about it in any detail, but just to point out that this research that we have conducted has very much been in the tradition of health disparities research, although the methods of being ethnographic and even phenomenological are maybe not so usual. So as you might very well know, in health disparities research, two interrelated concepts are frequently cited around which research has been conducted. One concerns what sometimes have been called structural barriers, you know, big economic obstacles, bureaucracies, fragmentation of service, that kind of thing. And then a more intimate but closely interrelated research focus on what are sometimes called interactional barriers, which are really much more about the communication issues between healthcare professionals and clients. But I keep emphasizing interrelated because, of course, these are all tangled up together. So our particular research has addressed some things that have been less studied in health disparities research, or so we argued to our funders, and I think it still holds true. Historically, certainly, there's been far less research concerning children, which link children, disability, and health disparities together. Also, a lot of the research that has been working on the interactional issues, which are more the forte, as you can probably already tell, of what I'm talking about, have tended to focus on patient-physician relationships without paying so much attention to the many, many other health professionals that are part of the healthcare experience and the healthcare encounter for parents. And that's quite important to the borderland quality of that experience from the parent's perspective. Also, a lot of research has been focused on retrospective information versus our ethnographic approach, which has been based on a lot of observations and even videotaping of clinical encounters. And finally, although there certainly are some longitudinal studies, there aren't so many that trace the impact of clinical encounters and relationships over time and across contexts, which is what our research has been designed to do. So, many methods, and you can ask me about them later. But the only thing to add, because they're in some ways traditional anthropological methods, is our microethnographic focus on videotaping, which is not always part of ethnography. Many settings, including not only institutional settings, but if, since we're following kids, and kids evidently go a lot of different places. I've been to Chuck E. Cheese and many other spots. So homes, neighborhood spaces have all become part of the study. And we've gotten funding from Maternal and Child Health and then a series of NIH grants over the years. The key research focus of the grant as a whole has been, of the study as a whole, has been trying to look at how communities of care that can cross bound the borders between the clinical world and the home world, how these are cultivated, how these partnerships are cultivated, where they run into trouble between clinicians and family caregivers, often in very daunting circumstances. So we've been interested in obstacles, but we've also been interested in, about when things work and why they work. How does that happen? And we've been very interested in focusing on African American families in the place of race and class and other social markers in this partnering up process. And have wondered how examining this partnering up process and its vagaries and how it works between family caregivers and clinicians, what this suggests about the production and potential amelioration of health disparities. So remember, I've said chronicity. So chronicity means, you know, there's not, either there's no cure or there's very unlikely cure. That's the kind of group of people we've been following. And it also means that a lot of the caregiving, and we know this also in looking at poverty, a lot of it happens with family caregivers, unpaid or poorly paid, and at home. So then finally, from our perspective, what can a narrative framework offer in addressing these kinds of questions? So I'll just point authoritatively to some doctors to say I'm not alone in being interested in narrative. There is, some of you might know about this, a narrative medicine movement, which has been very much physician driven in the last 10 or 15 years, in which medical schools have increasingly taught or tried to teach skills in to their students in learning how to tell and listen to stories, making one kind of argument. Here's a co-authored paper with Rita Sharon, who's at Columbia, who's a big narrative medicine person in the U.S., and who has argued that this is already happening in clinical practice. This is kind of very important to clinical practice, is this telling and hearing stories. And the two key people in the UK where this has also been a big movement have Trish Greenhall and Brian Hurwitz. Here's one of their quotes, like, why pay attention to narrative, you clinicians? Here's what they say. Even the most pompous professors have been known to warn their students. Listen to the patient. He or she is telling you the diagnosis. A more sophisticated view holds that when doctors take a medical history, they inevitably act as ethnographers, historians, and biographers, required to understand aspects of personhood, personality, social and psychological functioning, as well as biological and physical. Okay, so this narrative approach and these narrative methods, which have been an attempt to sort of humanize medicine, have also been part of social justice efforts around health disparities. And Rita Sharon, who I mentioned before, has, for example, described anthropologist clinician Paul Farmer. Some of you might know about his work. He's been at the forefront of the at the global level of health disparities issues. She describes him as a master narrator himself in his own writing, bearing witness to the trauma of individual patients and also in plotting the broad course of history from points of view of the oppressed. And so she cites him as an example, and I'll just quote Paul Farmer, who is very concerned with the political economy of healthcare problems and healthcare disparities, but at the same time also argues that stories are very important. And part of his argument is that they're important in conveying the experience of suffering. Because the suffering of the world's poor intrudes only rarely into the consciousness of the affluent, even when our affluence may be shown to have direct relation to their suffering. Because the texture of dire affliction is better felt in the gritty details of biography, I introduce stories. But he goes on to say that this is not merely a matter of being anecdotal, and cites an economist, who I'm sure I'm very familiar with, Amartya Sen, who reminds us of the need to move beyond, quote, the cold and often inarticulate statistics of low incomes to look at the various ways in which agency, or what Sen terms the capabilities of each person, how these are constrained. I also want to move beyond, in taking a narrative approach, a kind of an idea that we need to listen to personal stories. I think that's important, but for me, and what I want to do in this paper, is think about the way that narrative permeates clinical practice, not simply because people are telling or hearing stories, but because there are certain kinds of cultural genres or even archetypes that shape clinical encounters and that embody ideals associated with biomedicine as applied science, supply biomedical hope with possible happy endings to various kinds of disease stories, and run into all kinds of trouble in the case of chronic conditions. So there are three, which I'll get to, that I'm going to pay special attention to. You will recognize them all because they are not special to the medical world, but part of a cultural imaginary that is embedded in popular culture and has traveled globally along with biomedicine. One is the idea of healing as a kind of sleuthing or detective story, another as a kind of repair story, pairing the broken machine body, and a third as a battle. Of course you know these because they're familiar stories to all of us. So I'll just talk about them briefly and then introduce how they get played up and played out within actual clinical encounters. So the idea of healing as a science detective story in the canonical version, you know, the sort of Shakespeare of these archetypes, that part of the canon, the key protagonists are a doctor and the disease itself, the mysterious culprit of medical crimes. The clinician as sleuth has the task of investigating medical mysteries, identifying the hidden criminal who perpetrates crimes inside a patient's body, leaving traces in the forms of symptoms and signs that present puzzles to be deciphered. The analogy between the detective story and this image of clinical care is not an accident. The medical case as a narrative form actually developed alongside the detective story as a literary form. Arthur Conan Doyle, who gave us Sherlock Holmes, was himself a physician, and the figure of Holmes was inspired by a famous physician teacher of the time, a Dr. Bell, who was supposed to be a wizard of deduction and whose feats of clinical reasoning were legendary. And we can see a modern day version of this if any of you have watched this TV show House. And we can also see how technology has been updated and still to do this kind of detective work. When it comes to the ongoing treatment of children's chronic conditions, detective work often depends upon partnerships created between clinicians, this is now talking about our research, and family caregivers. Clinicians will routinely judge when they have parents who can help them in their detective work at home and ask for this help in detecting symptoms and signs. Families, for their part, try to enlist clinician detectives, not always successfully. For Andrina, if you remember, who it took a year of repeated ER visits to finally get a doctor to take her child's illness seriously, and only because she finally picked up her child and walked through the waiting room into the secretary's office and said, I'm not leaving, a year later, right? I'm not leaving until somebody looks at my child. Meanwhile, she was labeled in at least the clinical, one of the medical charts I looked at, as either mentally unstable or possibly an abusive parent, which is what she feared. So it can be hard to find a detective. Rambo Mom loves House. I don't know if you've ever seen this TV show, but he's a very cranky doctor. This is her hero, this kind of, no bedside manner, but relentless. Okay. Healing as machine repair, this biomechanical metaphor gives us a picture of illness in which, and of healing in which, nature, society, and the human body can be viewed as an assemblage of interchangeable parts that can be repaired or replaced from the outside. As a machine, the body is potentially fixable, and this is certainly not an abstract metaphor, but permeates clinical practice, and especially certain kind of specialties like surgical or rehabilitation specialties, and certain kind of diseases like heart disease. So, and of course, popular culture. And becomes more and more intricate with new biotechnology, this machine-body relationship. The war story, which is going to be the one I'm going to kind of focus on with a couple of examples for the rest of this, as you might tell from Rambo Mom as a character. In this one, of course, again, this canonical version, protagonists are fighting the war against disease, and the body is a kind of site, a battle site in which war must be waged. Like the detective genre, this narrative archetype also rose in the 19th century, though it has gone through several permutations as understandings of the body have changed. It doesn't merely assign, as we know, the body a, and even a post 9/11 version, version for children. So the body here is not merely a passive character, it too can mobilize resources to come to its own defense. In our study, children as well as parents become trained in learning to see their bodies as sites of this sort of internal battle. They are recruited by clinicians to serve as assistants in the war. So in the following example, a hematologist speaks with some enthusiasm about how he has made a little blood model, little plastic model, it's kind of like a Pac-Man, in order to facilitate his explanation to children of being, and even parents, of being HIV positive and about AIDS. He especially uses this model when he has to disclose to children that they are HIV positive. In the following exchange, he's decided that it's time to tell Tommy, one of the boys in our study, who was 9 years old at the time. He tells Tommy, so this is kind of, the Pac-Man here is a bad guy, right? Eats the germ. In the following exchange, he tells Tommy that a germ in his body has attacked his white blood cells. He explains that Tommy's white blood cells and T cells have gotten too low, and that the medications he's been taking could prevent him from getting sick. Using this model, he places a round kind of ball thing in its mouth, and it eats it, and the model lights up. Very graphic, as the doctor says. Then the hematologist explains, HIV is the germ that attacks and eats white blood cells in the body, but the medicine fights the germs. When he's done explaining, he asks Tommy if he has any questions. And Tommy has a few. He asks, is what I have worse than sugar diabetes? The doctor says, yes. Can friends catch my germ? The doctor, some people are pretty dumb about HIV. They respond like it's a kind of leprosy. But am I nervous about examining you? Tommy shakes his head. You can't go talking to everyone about what you have. Medicine is so important to keep your T cells fighting strong. Which cell does HIV attack? Tommy, the T cell. Doctor, do you have any other concerns? Tommy, I'm stuck on the dying part. The doctor, you have more chance of dying if you run out into the street and get hit by a truck. You can't die if you don't get sick first. You won't get sick if you take your medicine. So the doctor's words here reinforce the message that his body will mobilize to defend itself if Tommy does his part faithfully by taking his medicine. The danger of the storyline, of course, shows up here. If a treatment fails and the enemy goes stronger, patients may subtly be blamed or even blame themselves. From the family's perspective, this canonical image of biomedicine as battling disease becomes much more complex. As in the detective genre with Andrina, they may believe that they must fight to help keep clinicians in the battle. Parents may come to see themselves rather than the doctors as the primary frontline fighters, as in the following example, in which one of the mothers, Dottie, describes herself as having had to become a Rambo in caring for her severely ill daughter, Betsy, who has sickle cell anemia, sickle cell disease. And here's a quote from a speech she gave to, and there was a whole sickle cell research day, or sickle cell day at the hospital where parents and clinicians were, and she was asked to speak, and here's how she described what it was like for her and how she acted with her daughter. "What I do is I get in my Rambo mode. If my daughter gets just the sniffles, I get hyper alert. I grab all my machine guns, all my equipment, guns there to attack that organism or that whatever. I check the pulse. I listen, you know, watch her color. Got to get out there and just attack if something happens, or just really get things in place." And they make trips to the emergency room all the time because this can become life-threatening within a very short amount of time if you're so severely ill. So Rambo, you'll recognize him. And here's the kind of indigenizing of Rambo when Rambo becomes a mother. So here's Dottie. That's back to Rambo again. She has her battle. She's trying to persuade clinicians to take her perspective seriously. The weapons that she uses when she visits, here she's here for a second opinion, to try to figure out about whether her daughter has acute asthma or not. She brings her medical records. She brings x-ray. She comes in with a stack that's of material to give to this doctor to ask him to look at. He puts up the x-rays. And here she's working with her primary doctor, the hematologist. They're both, so here's her daughter in the middle. They're both separately checking their medical records. She has recruited him as an ally. These are stills taken from a videotape, and I only have a couple here, but we made stills out of them, and the body language is perfectly synchronous of this mother and this doctor as they're trying to figure this out. There's about 10 more, but I couldn't figure out where I put those slides. So, okay. I'll leave it there. Like a ferocious warrior, Dottie represents herself as on the front lines of the battlefield. But there's another genre, the genre of the transformative journey, also a very familiar one, a very culturally familiar one, that is the dominant genre, the border genre, that is very much the dominant one from the patient and family perspective. In this genre, they emerge as the key protagonists. And it's not that these canonical plots are unimportant, of battle and so forth, but from the parents' perspective, they imagine these as essentially subplots within larger narrative frames that encompass personal, familial, and community lives. So we can see it here, and we can see the mismatch between Tommy's question and the doctor's answer. So when 9-year-old Tommy hears from the physician that he is HIV positive and asks if he has any questions, saying he's stuck on the dying part, the physician answers, the hematologist answers confidently, "You have more chance of getting hit by a truck if your medications are taken." That's the, of course, battle story canonically. But it simply neglects the drama that Tommy's question is about. "What kind of story am I in?" he's asking. He has a mother he rarely sees but knows is quite ill. She has AIDS. His initial question is what I have worse than sugar diabetes, is not a clinical question, but a personal question. His grandparents are raising him. They're his primary family, and at the time of this session, his grandfather was very seriously ill as a diabetic. He'd already had a foot amputated, and he was, in fact, dying. So, of course, from that perspective, the idea that he has something worse than diabetes is missing the story that Tommy he's just simply missing the entire genre that these questions are coming from Tommy's point of view. Okay, back to Andrina. I'm going to tell you a very short story about how Andrina, the mother I introduced at the very beginning of this, my talk, how she comes to find a doctor who she feels that she can trust. And you remember this history of this one-year terrible history. So this finding a clinician you can trust who will really care about your daughter is no small thing for her. And I want to just give you an example of one 15-minute session to look at how both hope and trust are produced in this session in kind of micro ways that the clinician I don't think is ever aware of, actually. So this is a session in which Andrina, with their primary oncologist, in which Andrina and Belinda are taken into one of the little treatment rooms. They're waiting for Dr. Hansen to arrive and waiting tensely. Andrina's very tense because they've just been through recently another round of chemotherapy, and they've had an MRI taken, and Andrina will find out the news. You know, has the tumor shrunk? Has it at least held steady? Has it spread? So finally the doctor arrives. He smiles a greeting to Andrina but goes immediately to sit beside Belinda, who instinctively puts Andrina's daughter, who puts her hand over her chest where her port is, fearing that he'll give her a shot. She says nothing. And also in her other hand, she's clutched, she tends to do this when she goes, she's taken the otoscope off the wall and she's holding it tightly in her hand, so she's just sitting there with the, all right. And one hand that, and the other hand she's put her hand over her chest. He notices her protective move and smiles. No, I don't do shots. That's those other guys down the hall. I'm just going to check you out. Use my stethoscope. You remember this, don't you? And he shows her the stethoscope. She relaxes a little, letting her hand drop. He notices that she's got this otoscope and the ophthalmoscope in her hand, still clutched. He jokes, "You can't have those. Give them back." He playfully moves to take them from her. She snatches her hand away, grinning now. "No, I can have them," she shouts. "No, you can't," he said, raising her voice. "Yes, I can," she repeats, even more loudly, laughing now. "Okay," he sighs in mock defeat. "I guess I'll just have to listen to your chest." She hugs him and he puts his arm around her. She leans against him, and at this point, and only at this point, he turns to Andrina. And then with Andrina, he says, "Okay, I've got the results from the MRI, let's take a look at them together," and they look at them together, and he says, well, he shows her, compares it to the last scan, and he says, "It's holding stable. It's not shrinking, but at least it's not growing. The chemo might work yet." She sits down relieved. At least her worst fear isn't coming true. He then returns to Belinda's side and says he's going to check out a few more things, which he does, and which Belinda submits to with no protest. The room is silent. A couple minutes later, he looks up and asks Belinda and then Andrina, "So how was your Thanksgiving?" Andrina says, "Ugh, just my daughter and my grandson came over this year, very small." "Yeah," he says, "my wife and I planned this big family dinner, and then at the last minute, first my parents couldn't come, and then my brother and his family couldn't make it, and then the two kids canceled out. So it was just us and a huge table of food. We're still eating that turkey." He laughs, and Andrina joins him in the laughter. In considering the dramatic qualities, what just happened here, how is this a healing drama? It's not so obvious. To think about how this produces a moment of hope and healing, not of the tumor, but in a more complicated way, a healing about hope. We have to look at this from Andrina's perspective. Her heightened attention is not simply directed to his words or what he says about the tumor, but to the whole exchange among the three of them. She reads his body and what clinicians might consider the informal or unimportant or chit-chatty parts of the clinical session. She is assessing here whether he is doing all he can medically for her child. Race and class play a key role in the unstated text of this exchange. Will her child, though black and poor, or the child of a single mother, be given good care? Will this doctor do everything he can to keep her daughter alive? These are not questions that she can put to clinicians directly and get answers to. Are you racist? Aren't you racist? Right? Rather, the questioning has to be indirect, a reading of the clinical encounter itself. And so she reads the signs of his actions. She's even heard some negative gossip about him from other parents. Others have said they thought he's prejudiced against blacks. I don't know if it's true, but I don't care, she once told me. I thought that was a surprising comment. He's good to me. He's good to Belinda. He really takes care of her. And not just like a doctor to a patient, but like a person, like a... And here Andrina hesitated in her choice of words. Almost like a father to a child. Of all the actions that Dr. Hansen takes, what Andrina remembers best, the evidence that is most persuasive to her that he is doing the best he can, is his capacity to play with Belinda. Not just any play, but this yes I can, no you can't game. It turns out, and I only knew this because I was at home so much, that this was part of an intimate family play. This was a game that Belinda and her mother played together all the time. He has in fact echoed this home playful game and ritual in which Andrina tries to get Belinda to do things she does not necessarily want to do by telling her that she can't do them. And the sicker she gets, the more she seems to play this game in which Belinda gets to say no, no, no. Dr. Hansen has mysteriously acquired knowledge of this game and uses it for his own purposes to put this frightened girl at ease. But for Andrina, it's evidence that he has come to care for her daughter as a little girl, not just another cancer kid, as she put it. What does this reassure her of? Andrina's hope rests upon her trust that he's of his skills and that he's doing all he can, but this trust is based on her own assessment of her ability to traverse the clinical border zone. That is, maybe he is prejudiced, but she has been capable, her assessment of herself is that somehow she has been capable of giving him a likable enough child and a likable enough parent. Parents talk a lot about being able to have likable children for a clinician so they'll get good care. So a likable enough child that she's a skilled enough traveler in her view to ensure that he is drawing on all his medical skills. He's not just being a professional, but almost like a father, she says. When Dr. Hansen, in the end, fails to personally deliver the news that they can do nothing else and that Belinda will die, there's nothing left. He gives this job to the case nurse, as doctors sometimes do, to deliver. Because the battle's over for him, right? There's no more chemotherapy delivered, but the journey is not over for this mother and the daughter. When the case nurse tells her, and not Dr. Hansen, Andrina is shocked. I thought he'd be there for the whole thing, she told me, even for the dying part that happened. She wonders at this point if she was wrong to trust him after all, so she rethinks this, because the trusting him also meant that she felt she was a good mother. Even if she had spent a whole year, and maybe she should have been non-compliant before that, why did she listen to the doctors? She somehow thinks she has gotten a doctor she can trust, and then when he's not the one to tell her, she wonders if she has been a bad mother after all, not have found a doctor who really does care. And what about Dottie, Rambo mom, who I titled this paper on? What about her? Ah, I thought you should see one picture of, that's Belinda within the PT, doing a PT therapy exercise. So what about Dottie, Rambo mom? Paradoxically, Dottie's very clinical knowledge and adeptness is an indication of a tragic incommensurability at the heart of her effort to create a good life for herself and her daughter. Hers is hard-won expertise. It has cost her and her daughter a great deal. It's not simply that the price of such clinical competence is that she has, as she says, no life of her own for long stretches, or that she's had to return to living with her own mother, with whom she has a rocky relationship. The tragedy, the moral tragedy from her perspective, is that honing this medical gaze has separated her from her child. She has become acutely attuned to Betsy's body, and especially to the treacheries of her body, the face of serious illness. But because of this, Dottie has become less aware of her daughter's plight as just another little girl. she loses sight of how to be just a mother. And she tells this, recounts this one terrible moment when this blindness came to her with a kind of clarity. This was a time when Betsy was going to a sickle cell camp. It was her first time going alone to the sickle cell camp. So here's Dottie, the mother, talking. Betsy went on the bus to camp. She started crying, right? She's sitting there sobbing her little eyes out. And I'm like, Betsy, what's wrong with you? What's the matter? I'm looking at her trying to figure out why is she crying. I don't understand it. And then it clicked with me. Oh, she's crying because she's gonna miss me. Now, most mothers would know that, right? Me? Because I'm just trying to figure out, well, why is she crying? What's going on? Is she in pain? Is this happening? Is that happening? I'm trying to process all those things first. There's a lag or a delay. It really, really hit home for me. I'm like, my God, you know, I am really detached. Hence, learning how to become a Rambo, even the kind who can fight with clinicians as she does, can blow up at nurses as she sometimes does, protect her daughter in that way, has cost her a kind of softness in her view that comes with mothering and has somehow cost her daughter in another kind of way. Her daughter, who, as she says, prefers to go to the hospital and stay for her blood transfusions, has gotten to like it. How weird is that, she once said. Okay. Some lessons to be learned, and then I can open this up for discussion. And some of these, because I know many of you are really concerned with, or I assume that you are, with policy issues related to this kind of work. I want to just point out a few of the lessons that we in this research team have been taking from this work, and that I've tried to point out or illustrate in some ways today. So sort of a summing up. One thing I think this research speaks to is the need to rethink or maybe even resituate the idea of cultural competence. Certainly not to not train clinicians to become more culturally aware and capable of working with a variety of different kinds of patient population groups, but to recognize that rather than, as it's usually done, thinking of cultural competency as kind of the domain of the clinicians, they should become culturally competent at dealing with, you know, minority patients. Rather, our research has shown how much families have the real cultural competency challenge. They have to learn to travel in biomedical cultures and forge relationship with healthcare providers, and they have a lot more at stake. So they really need to learn this. You know, this view challenges the notion of the clinician as expert, which fails to reflect or encourage the distribution of expertise across family clinician partnerships. And of course, we anthropologists we love to say this, you know, biomedicine is a culture too. So this presumes, of course, that there's a cultural world or even multiple cultural worlds that that families are having to learn. And that these multiple cultural worlds are not only filled with specialized vocabularies, tools, and rituals, as they are, but they also have trade languages. This is something, for me, these archetypes that I've been talking about function as a kind of trade language because they inform the cultural imaginary and not simply, and these are highly dispersed narrative archetypes that people use to understand and navigate the clinical terrain. And obviously, these powerful narratives of battle and sleuthing and whatnot carry many dangers as well as affordances, as I tried to point out. The other big sort of takeaway point that I tried to illustrate a bit here in my talk and that has been a big part of our research is the way that healthcare, how much of it happens beyond the clinical world. How much the healthcare encounter is a very much of a short story within a much bigger health story from the family perspective. And that often even significantly ill children within our families, because many of them are very poor, that's only one subplot. It's sometimes not even the most important subplot in many other dramas and many other illness trajectories and many other issues facing families. I've talked about hope here in part because I I think it's important when we look at especially people at the bottom of the social ladder, not only to think about things like structural violence, as Paul Farmer talks about, or social abandonment. I think those are important concerns and important direction of focus. But I think it's also equally important not to kind of abandon people by naming them as victims, and to also look at practices of hope. How do people like Andrina or Dottie, how do they face their circumstances? How do they struggle to create good lives? What are the kind of tragedies that can befall this? It's not like a happy story necessarily. How does hope change over time? So that for Andrina, at first it's a hope that she can get a cure, but then it becomes a hope that her daughter will wake up from a coma so she can say goodbye one last time because she's not quite ready, to a hope that she can help other parents, as she does, whose children also have cancer, even after her daughter dies. So this kind of trajectory is a reconfiguring of hope that clinicians often mistake for denial, because they're not, because I think the clinicians are more in denial sometimes. Anyway, or don't have, let's say, the resources for a more complex version of hope. I've thought a lot about what Cornel West has called blues hope when he spoke about Obama's campaign, but I thought it really has fit very beautifully the kind of hope, hope without optimism, that is part of a lot of these families' project, a kind of moral concern to hope. And, you know, the tremendous work that parents do to try to have their children be just kids or have real childhoods wherever they can. So in this implotting that I've tried to do, what I'm trying to show here is the way that these clinical or canonical narratives are nested or situated within these larger narrative horizons of family and community in which no simple hope story is revealed or available. Okay, the end. Please.
Looking at that, I really enjoyed the talk, by the way, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm in sociology, mm-hmm. So you do have a spectrum of people here, probably closer to your disciplinary concerns.
Mm.
I find that slide very interesting, partly because I have a child who has serious medical issues, some of those points are very universal for families
right.
Facing the
yeah.
challenge of managing
yep.
a child's illness and health.
Yep.
And so I wonder, aside from the social abandonment, which I do think would be associated with class, how do you distinguish what's going on for families for the same kind of medical experience
yeah.
than families of any class?
Right, right, right. Can I just jump in?
Okay. Is it,
yeah. Well, it's the reason that I determined to tell you that little yes I can, no I can't encounter of Andrina and the oncologist is because yes, first of all, yes, I mean the kind of things that we're pointing out really point to something that is, it's universal. I mean, I've been doing research collaboratively with Danish anthropologists working in all kinds of, in Uganda and in Denmark and in other places, and this is not special to African Americans or poor African Americans in this at all. However, there are a series of specific concerns and kinds of questions that are tailored around race and class issues that, for example, Andrina has to ask. She is really on the lookout for whether race and class are playing a part in this oncologist care. And so, for instance, Belinda, her little girl, was supposed to have a bone marrow transplant, and then about 2 weeks before, which she knows and everybody knows is very expensive, and then about 2 weeks before it was scheduled to happen, the oncologist said, we can't do it, she's too sick. So she's having to make judgments. Is this a denial of care because I'm not private pay or because he is prejudiced? Is this a race class or is she really too sick? And how can she figure that out? How can she assess that? Partly she talks to other parents, you know, who she meets, and partly she watches these signs of the way he is with her daughter. And so within the universals of this are some specific concerns that that really speak to the social location of these parents, and strategies that they develop, like the extreme importance. I'll just show you. Okay, so there she is. For really poor parents, I don't know if this was your experience, but for poor parents, they really work to dress their children in the best clothes they have to go to the hospital or take them to the doctor when they're very sick. They're having to produce a child worthy of care, and that's a real concern. And even the aides, there were a lot of, we were in multiple clinics, but in this one hospital, there were quite a few of the aides who were also minorities in a group of African American aides. There weren't that many doctors, but there are a whole group of aides. And they would, if the parents weren't doing it, they would braid the children's hair if they were in the hospital or do other things to also make them ready to present to the doctors. So this was there were a lot of tasks that, of course, every parent is going to worry. Can I trust this doctor? Is he going to do everything he can? But I do think the social location produces a whole other layer here. And of course, the 1 year of emergency room visits, if she'd had a good doctor, maybe it wouldn't have been a whole year. Or, the lesson that you have to be non-compliant, you have to learn a just right non-compliance is the way we thought about it. Not too much and not too little. This is a lesson that probably also all parents have to learn to some level if they have a child with a serious condition, but really trying to learn how if the emergency room is your primary access to health care and so the clinicians don't know you, and of course the clinician's job is to separate emergencies from ordinary care. And from the clinician's point of view, if you're poor and if you're black, you're probably using ER for routine care and not for a real emergency. So you're already dumped in the wrong. So how do you, as a parent, figure out that special kind of just right non-compliance so you don't get kicked out, as can happen? Am I the...
I have sort of a follow-up question.
Okay.
Vicki, so if that's okay. So just sort of related to this,
yeah.
I don't know, I'm not very familiar with this style of research at all. So one question is part of your big research project also include tracking down these kinds of narratives from more advantaged families so that you can kind of compare how they emerge, or are you only focused on
African Americans?
The types of families that you were describing here.
In this research, we followed only African American families. There's a lot of literature, not replicating this particular research, but a lot of literature, certainly not mine, that documents historically these kinds of, even if it's not always called narrative genres or something, but how these images of the body as a battle site, or whether how they have developed over time, and studies among anthropologists and I'm sure other sociologists and others that have looked at how these play out in actual encounters. But we really focused. We decided we didn't want to do a comparison because comparison isn't important, but because it seemed to us that. That you can, it's not because comparison is important, but because we were kind of worried about making, a lot of studies seem to make, in some ways, over-reductionist or simple kind of compare, like white affluent have this kind of experience and poor have this other kind of experience. And so we were worried about that, and so we wanted to put our resources into really doing an in-depth study of this population. Having said that, I am going to try to do a comparison study. I put in an NSF grant. I don't know if any of us are ever going to get any money from the federal government again for any of these research projects, but I've submitted one which would narrow down the category of illness and chronic to ADHD and autism, and to look at an affluent white community in LA on the west side as compared to South Central in LA, because the numbers are staggering, as they are for African Americans in terms of the difference in the money, you know, that is attached to kids diagnosed with not only the diagnostic, the delay in diagnosis, the money for treatment, even if it's LA Unified. So I think in comparison could be very, very important. It's just, this was much more phenomenological, and yeah. So I don't want to say anything bad about comparison. It's just that I think sometimes it can be a sacrifice for the richness and depth of a within group study. So analytic choice. But you had a question,
yeah,
right?
Actually, I have two questions.
Okay.
You noted in Andrina's case that ethnicity was really salient in her interaction between her and the clinicians.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if it's gender at all came into play in terms of the way they perceived her as a female African American. And I'm wondering if you also, so the second part is, also looked at fathers.
Yeah.
So are there Rambo dads out there?
Yeah.
That, doing, picking up some fights.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, yes, I didn't pay a lot of attention to gender in this because it was primarily women, although we have several, we had many fathers, not many, many is an exaggeration. We had, I don't know the numbers, but of the, let's say, like 45 families, we had 52 kids because we had more than one kid in some families, and 45 families total, and of those, I think, of families who actively had fathers involved, I'd say maybe a quarter of them who were involved, and even might be the person this was more rare, but showing up at the clinical encounter. So, I think the issue of fathers is really important here. The fathers who came to the clinic with their children, especially if they were single dads, I actually thought they were given a harder time. I mean, I thought it was more difficult for them to create these partnerships than it was for the women. And I don't have that wasn't a key question. I don't have a lot. I can't generalize from that. But it seemed to, and they felt very much isolated. You know, the men, they felt that it was hard to even create alliances with other families because it was mostly mothers in the waiting room. And so because healthcare is so gendered, you know, I think they felt more stranded, many of them. And what was your other question I wanted to say? Oh, these Rambo, whether there's... Yeah, yeah. You know, this Rambo, this mother was the Rambo in the crowd, Dottie. Although, believe me, women, the mothers would fight if they had to, but again, they had to learn to fight cleverly. They learned, as Rambo mom would say, how to shuffle and jive. So she got into a big fight with a nurse or with the clinic. She would bring a basket of fruit or something the next day and thank everybody. So she learned all kinds of, you know, gift makeup things to not get kicked out altogether. So I would say race is really marked, but gender could be. If only I studied a group of dads. One of the PhD students who's been part of this project, and I haven't read his thesis yet, look specifically at fathers, you know, and what it's like for fathers.
You have all that data, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he also collected his own data too on fathers. So, and there's not that much literature on fathers and African American fathers, and it's hard to find. Yes. Okay. I don't know. I mean.
Yep. Back to Marianne's question, maybe a little bit but you mentioned at the beginning that you were hoping to sort of ultimately track outcomes and talk about how this research on narratives informs the disparities in
person. Right.
Talk about what the conclusions of the project have read with regards to disparities.
Yeah. Well, I think that the kind of conclusion, and this is one thing that ethnographers, to make our research even weirder than some other kinds of research, often the sort of conclusions or findings of ethnographic research are not simply in the form of kind of data that are set against hypotheses or findings in that ordinary way, but an idea that of using the research to actually rethink the hypotheses you begin with, or to reframe. So it's a and to have an iterative relationship between the data that you gather and the frame that you begin with. So, for example, this idea of resituating, just to go to the, this idea that we would need to resituate cultural competence or rethink cultural competence, this isn't something that I, we didn't go into the first study with this idea in mind. It actually emerged. So it's a kind of finding, but it's a funny kind of finding because it's rather a reframing suggestion with support from our ethnographic study about why it is that it it makes a lot of sense to really look at cultural competency also from the perspective of families. And so so it's not that we didn't find anything out, but a lot of the things we found out, or this idea of the importance, maybe this sounds obvious, but really the importance of for me, who had done a lot of research from more the clinical point of view, once I really started studying families, this idea of the clinical drama as being such a subplot, or even if a child is seriously ill, and it's crucially important to the family, it can only, it, you know, it actually may not be the most important thing going on. So, so from a narrative perspective, I would say that that has certainly led me to think about the difference between clinical versions of happy endings and family versions of happy endings, and to think about this idea of a journey, which is at one level just a kind of duh, you know, what else could there be? But really to begin to think about how in like the Tommy example, his sense of what story am I in is very different than the clinician. So this, seeing how these, seeing the limitations of the clinical work from a narrative perspective has also sort of helped me foreground how often questions that from a clinical side seem like clinical questions, is this worse than sugar diabetes, are actually much more phenomenological and much more it's a whole different narrative question. I want to say one other thing. The other thing is I never thought I was going to do a study about hope. Hope was not, I knew people cared about hope, you know, and clinicians would worry that their patients were in denial or that they didn't have enough hope. In my research among clinicians, hope was certainly a topic, but it wasn't a foregrounded part of the research when we started it in the MCH grant. You know, but then as I got more and more immersed in family lives, I thought, wow, hope is enormous, and it's not, it, and I have to learn to reframe or rethink hope because it easily can be tied to even travel with despair, you know, and very tied to, so Andrina can't give up hope on her daughter because what kind of mother would she be, as she says? She can't give up hope that a miracle might happen, as she puts it. So even though her hope changes over time, but so even when the clinician, when the oncologist gives up hope, she feels morally bound to a certain kind of hope for her daughter. Well, anyway, that would be a longer story, but I would say that's, you know, for me, these are the sort of theory takeaways or reframing takeaways that okay, I'll stop there. So, Ming, right?
Yeah. Actually, my question is about hope, so okay. This follows up.
Okay.
So I wonder if you could comment a little bit more on what seems to be the multiple layers of hope in this narrative that the families or the caretakers are sharing. I mean, obviously, one of the most important narratives of the hope is the hope for cure.
Exactly.
But it seems to me that from the experience, the ethnographic details or descriptions or stories that you're sharing, there's other layers of hope.
Yeah.
So, you know, for example, when Andrina, right?
Right, Andrina, yeah.
Wanted or was disappointed that the oncologist wasn't there to deliver the bad news.
Right.
What kind of hope was taken away from her?
Right.
Things like, I feel like there are multiple layers of hope, stories of hope that are not entirely reducible to the
right.
hope of cure.
Right.
And I wonder if you could say something more about what kind of hope those are.
What are they hoping for?
Yes. Thank you. Very nice question to give to me, because it allows me to say something that also was just as another sort of takeaway, because not only did I not know I was going to be paying so much attention to hope, I didn't have this idea of the kind of hope I would be seeing and how it would change over time. I would not have anticipated this before I started this study, and I have thought about this more and more. I have moved more and more into looking at the connection between hope and morality. And by morality, I don't just mean a kind of code or something, but rather the way that, in fact, I have another book coming out that is kind of re-looking at virtue ethics, which has been a topic in philosophy, with some of the same research material in fact from the same study, because part of what hope seems to involve here that is not just about cure is about being the kind of parent who can tolerate this level of despair, for one thing, and being able to the parents would say to gain the strength. So hope requires a huge amount of strength. And parents sometimes, when they first hear a diagnosis, or they'll say in early interviews, I just don't know. I don't know if I'm strong enough for this. You know, I don't have the strength. I don't know. What can I do? You know, how will I? So that it's a very morally inflected picture of hope. And that has cultural roots. I mean, partly because the families in this study, most of them are Christian, so you can see the Christian roots to that. But I would never want to reduce it to a simple Christian version of hope, in the sense that it's this morally difficult and troubled practice that. That parents, and even it's a burden, you know, it becomes a real burden to hope. One of the people Andrina was closest to was another mother whose daughter also had this same kind of brain tumor, so they met in the hospital. And that mother said, you know, if they give me a do not resuscitate on my daughter, I'm going to go with that. I'm not going to fight that. And Andrina befriended this mother, and they stayed close, but they had very, very different perspectives. They're kind of this, you know, in many ways similar from the sort of subject position idea. You would count them as the same, but they had very different approaches to this. For Andrina, she couldn't, that was not a possibility. But what she did worry about is that if her daughter died, she would commit suicide. So this hope turns out to be very much both morally inflected about what does it mean to live a good life. Maybe it's a good short life. At the funeral, Andrina stood up. I was shocked at her daughter's funeral that she would stand up to speak, and she said, you know, my daughter did everything she could, and everything that was possible for her happened. You know, we gave her whatever we could, and now she's healed in heaven. So she used that, her Christian vocabulary, but she also linked it to being a good mother. And then she really worked, I should quit telling stories, she really worked to befriend, she found Dr. Hansen, even when he didn't, she went to the hospital and she wrote him notes. She finally found him because she's trying to preserve, and they sort of remade a relationship, in part because she's trying to preserve, I think, her idea of herself as a good mother, which then depended on him being a good doctor. So, and her hope is connected to that. So there are many moral layers to this, but, yeah.
Thanks. Do I have time for one more quick question?
The applicability of what you're studying to healthcare now, mm-hmm. I'm a registered nurse on the transplant unit.
Right.
I also spent 3 weeks in children's nursery with a niece who had a brain tumor.
Uh-huh.
she's 11, and she's now 8. So, and that whole experience was amazing. But I'm wondering, like Dr. Hansen, for example.
Yeah.
Or many others like that, myself included.
Right.
Practice in healthcare, to stay with the patient through this.
Yeah.
I think that's part of my experience. We wrote a paper on illnesses, metaphorically, illness. And I wrote about it as a theater.
Yeah.
That whole experience with my niece about it was a tragedy.
Yeah.
But it was not without levity. But,
right.
You know, and how do we take what you're doing and move it where I work so that we implement the idea of staying
with
the patient?
Right.
Yeah. It may not be cost benefit for economists necessarily, but I know if I'm choosing a healthcare plan in November, I'm thinking about things like this. And that's exactly what I tell patients.
Yeah.
You get to choose in November whether
you're
doing a good job or not.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's a really important question. One of the reasons I raised the very briefly mentioned what's going on in the narrative medicine movement among physicians is because some of these same issues they're trying to raise as well, which is, or in maybe a slightly different way, which is, as my way of seeing it, is that because Dr. Hansen is so wedded, and in a way it's a simpler story, to the idea of battling the disease, and then when the disease wins, the battle's over, right? So the story's at its end. But I think the idea of helping clinicians to become more reflective about the culture that they're living in and they're trafficking in and how these narratives are getting played out. I think also that many of the clinicians in this research don't know when they're doing good work. I mean, I think if he had known, he probably wouldn't have made the case nurse do it. I think if he had understood that he had a part in another story, not only in the story where he's the general of the battle and then the general has to admit defeat, but where he's like got a smaller part in a different narrative that even God is part of, you know, and he's just there for that piece. So I think, not for everybody, but from Andrina's perspective. So I think that if there was a way to help clinicians be more attentive to what role are they, who are they, you know, if they can figure it out, in some of these family plots or personal plots. I think that would be very helpful.
So let's thank Cheryl and people
who
still have questions, maybe for a few more minutes
afterwards. Fine. Thank you. Thanks very much, and thank you for your questions. Okay, and now I can become unhooked.